host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDOcast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy, Sean Shapiro. Sean, what's going on, man?
Not too much, man. I guess I'm technically in your country right now, but farther away, since I'm a little bit farther east and in Toronto right now for kind of a charity hockey tournament thing that's going on here this weekend. And got to, watch Leafs Bruins last night with some of the organic Leafs fan, which was always an interesting experience. So
nice. Immerse yourself with the locals there. Yeah, you're doing some boots on the ground reporting. We're going to start off talking about Bruins Leafs game six that happened Thursday night, and that's the most recent thing for us to talk about. We're going to bounce around after that and do a variety of different things, so looking forward to that. But let's start with Bruins Leafs. So I've got a few takes that I jotted down as I was watching because I knew we were going to discuss this today. Here's my first one. That first period was, I think, the worst hockey I can remember in a meaningful game, and it wound up working out for the Leafs, right? I think the game certainly picked up as it went along, and they got their win. They forced the game seven. We're going to discuss all that stuff. But I think the reason why I note that is because that first period ends with them being up 12-1 on the shot clock, right? And then throughout the entire broadcast, as that period was unfolding, then into the intermission panel, it kept being referenced, in particular because the Bruins similarly had a very low shot total in the previous game as well, right? And it was kind of, the stat was brought up about how many they had combined in the first periods between the two games. And I think, to me, it's really highlighting a big theme of this postseason that you keep circling back to, but also I think just a general kind of paradigm shift that we're heading towards quickly that's happening in these games that are being played, just in terms of like what teams are strategically trying to do, how they're succeeding in doing so with increasing frequency, and how that's, I think, shaping the way I'm watching and analyzing these games, and how maybe other people are sort of lagging behind, I guess, in recognizing it. And it's that the shot clock has become almost irrelevant, in my opinion, in discussing what's going on in a hockey game in 2024. I'm sure there's people that are going to argue that that's been the case for a long time now, right? Think of the Barry Trotz Islanders teams that made the Eastern Conference Final in back-to-back years. They sort of prided themselves on not caring particularly about shot attempts, but shots on goal as well as a result, and really just focusing entirely on scoring chances, right? Now, I think that can be a bit precarious because it's obviously easier said than done. That limits you to fewer events. I think it increases the sort of volatility in it, and it's tough to just replicate over time. But I think we're seeing this postseason, and I'm curious for your take on all this. The teams are so far skewed now in that direction where we're seeing all these games that the shots on goal are finishing 22-20, right? Teams are finishing in the teens, and that's not necessarily because they're playing poorly. It's entirely by design, and they're actually considering that a job well done, I think.
I love the line, the shot clock is irrelevant. Like that to me is that's my takeaway. That's the ball that's going to be rolling around in my head the rest of the day as I walk around today. So I love that ideology here, because you're right. It's becoming, you watch these games and you kind of see how teams go and everything like that. And using just the shot counter is trying to apply the same. It's trying to basically paint everything with one brush when it's not answering the question of, are the teams doing what they want? Are they achieving their goal of how they want to play? And I'm giving you a ton of credit right now, because I like you kind of summed it up really well. The shot clock is irrelevant. That's something that's going to be bothering me as I watch both these games tonight. I'll just be thinking about it.
Well, because in this game, I think it was such a good example of it, because the shots were 12-1 for the Leafs.
Yeah.
And like, I was tracking it live, and I had scoring chances at 3-3 after that first period. And in fact, for a while, it was like 3-1 Bruins, and despite the fact that they only had one shot themselves. And I don't know, it's interesting because obviously everyone defines a scoring chance differently, right? So it's kind of subjective in that sense, whereas I think it's much easier, although certain buildings certainly have been known to either inflate or devalue what a shot on goal is, depending on their loose definition. But I do think it's an interesting sort of weighing the two against each other.
Well, which goalie would you, from a goalie perspective, like, and you could probably ask Woodley next time you have him on, would you rather, if I'm going to tell you there's three, if scoring chances are going to be 3-3, would you rather be the goalie facing 12 or the goalie facing one? Because honestly, if you're the goalie facing one, you're you're probably in a less ideal position. You're not getting the easy volume. You're not, quote unquote, feeling the puck or whatever terminology you want to use. Where if I can tell you, hey, scoring chances are going to be even, that's not a big deal to me. That if you got outshot by 11 to 1, by 11, that's not a big deal. That's a, there's a lot of noise there, right? Like, I think that's another key thing to think about this, because at the end of the day, the goal is to get as many goals behind the goalies. And so when you lay out those two scenarios, which one is more difficult? Which goalie faced a tougher night in period one last night?
I think it would depend because I do think the shot attempts were relatively even for the most part, like for a long stretch of that. And I think from a goalie's perspective, I might be incorrect here. You're right. Like I should just ask Woodley this and then get out of the way and just let him cook for 50 minutes and present that as a full show one day. And maybe we will do so here in the future. But I imagine the shot attempt is kind of important from the goalie's perspective because it's something you just have to prepare for. So whether the
Oh
puck
yeah, it
makes it
is.
to you or not, right? It's irrelevant in the sense that obviously if the shot gets blocked, you didn't have to really do anything, but you still had to act as if the shot was going to come to you, right? You're not just taking it for granted that your defenseman is going to stop it before it gets to you. So you're still getting in your stance, you're still doing the same save selection
You're
and
still, yeah,
technique. And so
you're still
I
head tracking and everything like that.
exactly. So if the shot attempts are equal, but one guy's faced significantly more shots on goal, the goalie who's made more saves gets more credit for it. But I think in reality, both guys have to do kind of the same amount of work in terms of like what their actual job requirement and responsibility is.
I will push back slightly on that, because there is the, if every shot is getting blocked and everything like that, there is the, like you and I talked after game one of the Dallas Vegas series, and we talked about Logan Thompson looking uncomfortable and everything like that. Like, you don't get that chance to be uncomfortable unless you're actually handling the rebound control, the post
True.
save, everything like that. So I will push back on that
Oh, that's
slightly.
a
I
good
get what you're
point.
saying. I think from the head tracking, from getting your body going and everything like that, they're very similar, but it's the post save action, not creating more problems for yourself, making the proper read on whether to catch a puck that's low or hot, like a puck near the pad, right? A lot of, some goalies intentionally try to catch as many as they can that are low. Others, the glove rarely goes below the pad. Like, things like that, that I think you don't get unless those shots are getting through. So.
No, I think that's a really good point and distinction. In your question about what you'd kind of prefer, I do think in watching like the Predators Canucks series, Juuse Saros is a goalie who I generally think of as being one of those that you would put in the camp of like benefiting from a lot of activity. Like it seems like he sort of is at his best and thrives in these chaotic environments where he's flying around and having to make a ton of saves in succession. And you look up and he's stopped 45 or 47 Puxy's face, and you're like, wow, like that was an amazing Juuse Saros performance. Now, in this series, he's facing like 17 or 18 shots every single game, and he's still having to make a bunch of high degree of difficulty ones. But I do think it might explain why he doesn't necessarily look as sort of like sharp and refined, I think, as you generally think of him as at his prime. For most of the year, especially early on, I think that was the case. But I think this series in particular is kind of, I think that's a possible explanation for why he's looked the way he has, because he certainly, we have such high expectations for him. And he was really good in game five to force the game six and extend the series when he was called upon. But I think it's a bit of a unique challenge for him in that case.
Yeah, he's very much a rhythm goalie, right? Like, that was when I was covering Dallas closely, it was one of the unique things about going from Anton Hudobin to Ben Bishop, basically, when they were effectively splitting the season as a 1A, 1B, where Hudobin was a guy who, if he could get 10 to 12 shots in the first period, kind of get his legs going, get his body going, those were the games where he would have one of those, like, Anton Hudobin, I could turn it on for 30 minutes as the best goalie in the world type games. But if a first period was slow or whatever, he would get kind of lost in the game and wouldn't really be super effective. Meanwhile, one of the things that made kind of Ben Bishop the undoubted number one as you went into the playoffs every year and anything like that, was Ben Bishop could face one shot in the first period. He could face 40 shots in the first period, and he was going to be the exact same goaltender. And I think Saros is a good example of a guy who, the way he plays, the approach, the way he kind of has to play, it being 5'10" and everything like that. I know he's listed at 5'11", but whatever.
That's very, very generous. Yeah, that's probably on his,
I know.
I'm sure on the dating apps, he's actually
Yeah.
6 foot.
Yes, exactly. And he's I think he's a guy who's always kind of thrived on getting things going early. And it's hard to be a rhythm goalie in series where there's 20 shots. It's where you're actually only not touching the puck as much and everything like that. So
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly a level you have to reach, I guess, like before it becomes a problem. Like, I would argue that the Canucks averaging 18 shots on goal per game so far through five games, as we're talking, isn't ideal for their purposes. Like, I'm sure, regardless of whatever the chances are or how they feel about how they're like what they're doing with those shots, you still want to get to a certain point just because, especially in the postseason. We see time and time again, while hope isn't necessarily an offensive strategy, there's so many dumb goals that happen of like,
Yes, there
and
is.
you look
Yes.
at even like circling back to the Bruins Leafs game, the first goal they scored, the Leafs did, and pretty much the goal that won them the game. I know the Bruins scored with 0.1 seconds left to make the second Willie Nylander goal, the official registered game-winning goal. But for all intents and purposes, it was that first one. It was like a fadeaway point shot that bounces in off Charlie McAvoy and beats Jeremy Swayman, which is pretty much the only way you can really beat him these days with how locked in he is. And we see that time and time again. Now, obviously, having that be your primary strategy isn't a good thing, as we've seen with the Hurricanes over the years in previous postseasons, because at some point those pucks will stop going in against a good goalie, and then you're just going to have no other recourse for generating offense. But I do think like you want to mix in a variety of looks, right? And that's why it's kind of tricky if you're passing up every single shot opportunity to look for the absolute best possible high danger chance. At some point, you are going to limit yourself in a certain sense, and that might not be ideal. But yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of like what teams are prioritizing and how these games are playing out. Because I think when I first started doing this in the early 2010s, like shot attempts actually working, like that was the best predictor for figuring out how a team was playing and who was good and what mattered. And then it got sort of narrowed down into shots on goal more so. And then now I think it's getting narrowed down even more into scoring chances. And I'm sure at some point it's going to become like only high danger scoring chances. We're going to keep like whittling away until it becomes this sort of one thing that every single team is trying to accomplish. And then it'll be interesting to see whether we reach a point of diminishing returns, but I don't think we're there yet.
It's just the same right where every time I have an opportunity and you're talking to coaches, I always am kind of doing a bit of my personal digging to kind of get an idea of what data, what metrics NHL coaches actually care about. It's kind of one of those like common things that if I get a chance in a conversation and everything like that. And I know, for example, like Andrew Brunette, like I wrote the story about him in the middle of the season. Obviously, this was before the Predators even had even gone on their run and were even looking like a playoff team. And one of our additional parts of our conversation then was he talked about how it was all about scoring chances. Everything was about scoring chance. It wasn't about shots. It was about creating the best ones. And you get other snippets from that from other coaches too, where some will be more honest than others, but basically at the end of the day, they're looking at that scoring chance chart. Or you'll see sometimes a coach gets frustrated after a game and they'll be like, "Well, we only had three scoring chances in the first period," like where they're all of a sudden they and it's to me that is the biggest telltale that coaches are starting to slip up and letting everyone know that this is really where it's going. It's interesting too because it's very similar to NHL hockey is starting to look a little bit similar in this way to what if you go and watch like an SHL game or a European game where a lot of European hockey is based off of wait, delay, create a prime chance, and it's very much quality over quantity. And I don't think it's completely the same. I think it still looks a little bit more four corners offense when you watch an SHL game, like I watched a little bit this past week. But the NHL is starting to take more of those elements now when it comes to, you know what, this nothing shot attempt is just a nothing shot attempt.
Yeah. Oh, I think this stuff's incredibly fascinating. Obviously, from the team level in terms of what they're trying to accomplish with their game plan and their ability to execute it, but also I think from us as fans from watching it, right? Because so often I think we've just defaulted to just looking at that shot counter and just being like, oh, well, this team has this many more shots, so they must be controlling the play. And as I've just been watching this postseason, it's really become so obvious that that's just like a wild misrepresentation for the most part, right? Like you just have to dig deeper beyond that. And so I think that's fun.
It used to be one of the things that I used to be a big believer, and my opinion probably changed on this in the last, I don't know, I probably had my come to Jesus moment to your line of thinking on this probably within the last year and a half or so. But like, I used to be a big believer that we need to see the shot counter in the scorebook at all times, right? Like, it used to be like, I used to think it was something where, like, hey, I want that tool where if I turn the game on at the 12-minute mark and I haven't watched the first 8 minutes, I see the shot count. I at least have some sort of tool that tells me how the game has gone, right? In a 0-0 game or whatever, more than the score. I have started to actually revert a little bit on the other way, where it's, I think sometimes we almost, it's like the shot counter sometimes becomes the crutch on us for some, where we look at it and it stops us from actually seeing what's happening. And I have gone from being the person who'd be like, oh, I want to see the shot counter in every scorebug, to now I don't care anymore. And I think that's another reflection of where this has gone. And I'm a smarter person now because of how I watched the game and had my come to Jesus moment, I guess.
Well, isn't it also ironic, and it's so NHL, I think, that like for years we were all begging and pleading for these broadcasts to all include the shot counter. And then now I think it's pretty much universally adopted. Like pretty much every single broadcast does have them. I know like sometimes ESPN takes it off to flash other various stats, but for the most part, they're still up there throughout the course of a game. And now it's becoming like, all right, I actually need other stuff. Like please give me a running tally of like offensive zone puck touches or something per team or something like that. Like I don't even know if offensive zone possession time is even that indicative. So yeah, it's fascinating to see how the game's changing. And I think that's a good thing, right? Like it can be frustrating when not everyone is on the same page and we're not necessarily all coming to this realization at the same time. And then you're like hearing people talk about it. It's like, ah, oh, that's not right. But that's also makes for fun debate. And I think that's always going to be the case with sports. So on that series, I want to talk to you a little bit about Jim Montgomery, a coach that you covered. We've spoken about him at various times over the past couple of years. And in watching this Bruins team, it's amazing, right? Because for years, we've spoken so much about the Leafs and how they've been haunted by their past history in these big moments and these games and losing game sevens and all that stuff, right? In the postseason. And yet now you're watching this Bruins team, and I honestly don't think it's lazy analysis or kind of cliched to discuss how their game is sort of changing as this pressure mounts, because you watch these past couple games and it's clear that they're playing, whether it's a bit more like reserved or tense or what have you. I think the pressure that's mounting, and also as they're approaching nearer to this like possibility of a truly catastrophic collapse, right? Like the idea of losing back-to-back years when you're up 3-1 with two of the final three games at home, no less, and blowing both those series. And then even for the coach in Montgomery, extending even beyond that before he came to Boston with some of his track record in these kind of closeout pivotal games, you see it kind of like just the execution isn't the same as it was. They're not nearly as sharp. And I think it makes sense for a team that, like, I think a Florida, for example, or a Carolina would treat these games slightly differently because they're so frenetic and chaotic and the puck's bouncing everywhere that they can just kind of, as long as they keep moving and keep competing, the game won't look that different. But this Bruins team is so structured and so much built on like precision and execution that I do think once you get into that human element of like, oh no, this is a really important game, and you know, we're steering into trouble here, I do think that would impact the way your decision making and the way you're playing.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, it is a human sport played with human emotions and human impact, right? There's the it's not just plugging in video game characters, and that is something that's, I think, important here too. And the Montgomery one is interesting too, because it's like, as you said, like, I covered both of his seasons in Dallas when he was there. And in 2019, Dallas had a 3-2 lead in the second round against St. Louis, and looked absolutely awful in game six at home, dropped a 4-1 loss and just got rocked. And then they go to St. Louis for game seven and just got they went to two overtimes because Ben Bishop had one of the best games of his career. And it was just it looked completely small in the moment. I was there. I covered both those games in person. Dallas looked completely small in the moment. They didn't do anything like that. And at the time, it's something where looking at the evidence of the moment, you're like, oh, that's something you look at the whole team. But it's hard not for me to think about that when you look at Boston dropping the 3-1 series lead last year. And we see him, in my opinion, he got out coached by Paul Maurice last year in that Florida series. And then you go into this series, and I don't think he's getting out coached by Sheldon Keefe, but I don't think it's kind of one of those things where it is a, whether it's just an unlucky, whether he's just an unlucky stat about Jim Montgomery, where he's lost seven straight chances to close out an opponent, or something that he's causing. I don't know which it is, but the evidence to me is there's definitely something here that needs to be gotten past. The other interesting thing about last night that I sent you the clip of it because I saw it, is after the game, Jim Montgomery basically goes out to call out David Pastrnak for, it's like, we need Pastrnak to step up. We need yada 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 yada. That's been when Jim Montgomery has, in his time as in Dallas, when he was struggling, he would, his bag was to go to calling out top players. It was that was his crutch when the team was struggling and he was didn't know how to get going. A lot of people in Dallas might remember the times when he said, he had the famous quote where, I've not been able to get rid of the culture of mediocrity. And that culture of mediocrity came, those comments came soon after he ripped into Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin for not stepping up. This came in that same era when Jim Leitz very famously called me into his office to just overly amplify that opinion as well.
Well,
I think people
they
remember
were
Jim
playing like
Montgomery.
horse poop. Was that the quote?
Yes, exactly. And I
Yes.
mean, yes. And like that was something that was co-signed by Jim Montgomery and everything like that. So I don't want to, it's one of those things where I'd love to, I don't get to be a fly on the wall in the room. So I don't know exactly what's happening there all the time and everything like that. But it is the reality where if you are looking at the common thread for this and where things go and how his teams have tended to kind of collapse upon themselves, and they go from, they start getting, the structure starts to disappear and they start to get more skittery and everything like that. It's to me, there's a common thread there that the Bruins have to figure out before game seven, and their head coach has to figure out, because I don't think, I mean, what, asking David Pastrnak to turn into Superman, I don't think that's the best way to try. I don't think that is going to fix all your problems from what actually was bothering you in game six.
Well, I do think this stuff, particularly in the postseason, can really take a life of its own at times and sort of impact results. The beautiful thing about sports, for the most part, is that you do get to control and write your own narrative in the sense that no matter how bleak things seem, all that really matters is the most recent thing you've done. So, like, instantly, if you just win one game or one series, all of a sudden, all of that gets thrown out the door, essentially becomes irrelevant. Now, I think part of the trouble here is that that's probably more so the case for players, especially star players, who can sort of more directly control the outcome of that because they're responsible for what's actually happening. As a coach, you can push all the right buttons, motivate your players, tactically prepare guys, divvy out ice time accordingly. And if the players don't get it done or if things happen, it's kind of up to chance for the most part, right? And I think that can be very frustrating. I did think that was very interesting, his post-game comments, because it was pretty cutting, like in terms of like what you're going to hear a coach in real time during a series say about a star player. Because he sort of prefaces it or couches it with talking about his effort, and I do think he's right. Like, I think Pastrnak's effort has clearly been there in this series, and you really cannot question that, which isn't always the case for a lot of scorers when they're struggling. But then he sort of goes, like, he talks about how in these big moments, like, you need your star players to produce. And he goes, Ben Marchand has done that. Now, like, David Pastrnak needs to, right? And so kind of comparing the two in different lights, I think, was very, very dramatic on his part. I will say, though, I think he's right. I'm not necessarily sure that, like, doing so in that
Oh, it's
setting
not.
is the way to do it.
Yeah.
But I don't even think he needs David Pastrnak to be superhuman. I think he needs David Pastrnak to be David Pastrnak, because in this series,
That's fair.
he simply
Yeah,
has
that's
not
fair.
been good enough, right? Like, he scored two goals. He's not I've got him down for 11 scoring chances in 5 games, like for him, or 6 games. For him, that's not enough. Like, he's such a high volume chance generator and scorer. And what I have noticed that's been interesting, and this is credit to the Leafs, because I think they did a really good job of preparing for this and pre-scouting defensively, and then focusing on an important sort of tool in Pasternak's bag, is like he loves to circle around behind the net in the offensive zone and then kind of pop open into the slot and then quickly turn around and like whip a puck on net, and it instantly becomes a high danger chance. And every time he tries to do that in this series, there's a Leafs defender that's like right on him, and he doesn't even have a chance to really release it properly the way he does in the regular season. And so that's credit to them, because that's just that's
Well,
phenomenal pre-scouting.
that's one of the things you and I talked about before the playoffs, where one of the great things about playoff hockey is teams actually get to focus on what the other team does. And that's a key thing that we sometimes see with top players, where with Pastrnak, that's a good example of one of his traits and one of his habits. You can say something about that in game 62 of the regular season, but you're not hammering it down for 3 days of video work because we have to play another team 2 days later. It's one of the things that I think happened with one of the things I give credit to Jason Robertson's game with this year after last year was I think teams picked up a lot of his tendencies last year and they really kind of hammered down on him quite a bit. And then this year, I think I've seen Jason Robertson be a little bit more of adjusted and things like we just saw the goal against Vegas the other day, the kind of the walk across instead of doing one of the two things he normally does, adjusting to like I think that's one of the great things about playoff hockey is there are we find ways that players have to become problem solvers. And the Leafs have done a great job of taking away another thing. Now Pastrnak has to be a problem solver in another way.
Yeah.
So
No, I love that. That is one of the best parts of playoff hockey. No, we're getting to game 7, which is fun. After game 4 or whatever, before game 5, when it kind of became clear that Matthews was going to be out and miss game 5, and then he missed game 6 as well, I posted in Discord kind of jokingly, but I was like, I know that unequivocally, like, this decreases their chances of winning because he's one of the three best, most impactful players in the entire league, and he's unbelievable, and he's the only reason they've won a game so far. Yet I have no doubt in my mind that the Leafs are just going to win the next couple of games, because this is playoff hockey, and this, like, it was always going to be the most chaotic, dumb outcome in terms of like the run out of how this was going to shake out. It would never just be as simple as like, oh, well, you lose your best player and you're done. And so in this case, we're getting a game 7, and it's going to be highly dramatic and fun. And so looking forward to watching that this weekend. All right, Sean, let's take our break here. And then when we come back, we'll pick it back up and finish the week strong. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here on the Hockey PDOcast with Sean Shapiro. Sean, let's bounce over to Stars Knights. And I did a breakdown of the series with our pal David Castillo recently. So I think a lot we covered a lot. I left a little bit of meat on the bone that I wanted to circle back with you to, because I think it's going to double as a good entry point for us into like a deeper conversation about coaching in the playoffs. And it'll go along with a theme of what we just talked about with Jim Montgomery. So I think it all kind of ties together neatly. But during our conversation about Wyatt Johnson, I'll start with this. I was kind of raving about his performances postseason and how good he's been in this series and how he's like really elevated his game and distinguished himself as Dallas's best forward. In that conversation, I forgot to mention, but I also just forgot as we were talking about last year's West Final between these two teams in terms of how it went for Johnston, because I went back and looked at it and he really struggled in that series. He got outscored 5-0 at 5-on-5. He had like a 36% expected goal share. He was held pointless in nearly 100 minutes of ice time. And obviously, there's a multitude of reasons why they lost. He's not anywhere near the top of that list. But the reason why I point that out was it is interesting to kind of, especially for such a young player, where he was what? He was still a teenager at the time, I believe, if not, if he had not turned 20 yet, as kind of like a learning experience, what that series was. And then now how heavily relied upon he is as a player, right? Where he's leading the Stars in ice time in this series amongst forwards, as opposed to being this kind of fun story as a middle six contributor for them. And just the value, I guess, of like getting those reps, even if it comes as a humbling in a way, in terms of like, all right, this is still what I need to work on, what needs to happen for me to improve and get to that level. The young players sometimes don't get in the postseason because whether it's after an early mistake or whether it never even happens in the first place, coaches so often default back to, you know, their trusted veteran players and kind of leaning on those guys. And we're going to run through some other examples that we've seen of that in this postseason, but I think Johnston is kind of a good example of kind of working through that and how he's now benefited from it this season.
Well, we also have to bring a fair context to this on Wyatt Johnston. Wyatt Johnston was pretty good against the Wild and the Kraken in the
He
first two
was. He
rounds,
scored,
and
I think he scored
so
the series winner against the Kraken, right? Yeah.
in that games in game seven against the Kraken, he had
Yep.
the so he was it's not like he was a guy who had kind of, I think, in Pete DeBoer's mind was already a quote unquote veteran. DeBoer had played him all 82 games. He had played him all 82 games. He was quite good in the first two rounds, and then so him kind of struggling in round three, it didn't really, I think it was a slightly humbling spot for Johnston. It also kind of got buried in the larger narrative because so much of that series basically became a, well, it's two overtime games, and then it's two overtime games that could have gone either way, and then Jamie Benn loses his cool. Like then that just narrative overshadowed everything in that Western Conference Final Series last year. So I think the Johnston story from last year's playoffs is more so of, I think it's twofold. It's one where just because a young player has played well against one team in the playoffs doesn't mean it's just going to hum along exactly against every team. There might be different reasons and matchups and whatever. And the other thing is you have to, not have to, but I think you have to remember the intrinsic value in allowing a player to actually establish himself. So you can look at things fairly, right? Like I'm sure I know for Dallas last year with him, with Johnston in that Vegas series, it's something where they expected him to be better and everything like that. But it was the spot where you kind of knew based off what happened to the other two that there was something else there. And I think that's kind of the key to the Johnston story. It's not like this was a round one series and he just struggled and he came into this year. Like Wyatt Johnston coming into this season and this postseason is not some guy where it's like, oh, well, he struggled in the playoffs last year. It's like, no, he knows how to deliver in the playoffs. He did it last year for two rounds. He just kind of he hit a bit of a wall or what everyone is against Vegas. And this year he has proven that maybe, I don't know, maybe it was timing. Maybe this is a question that you and I put a pin in and see how Wyatt Johnston looks when he's playing his 100th game of the season. Because maybe that's something to it too. That's another key point for us to think about later.
Certainly, especially for a player who had previously been playing significantly less, obviously at lower levels, but even like just in terms of the volume of games. No, I'm with you, and you're right, because that's kind of why I forgot that it was even part of that playoff run, because I thought that he was so good last year as a rookie with the context of how young he was, but also just in general. And then I remember the big moments he had in the first two series, and I kind of forgot that he had had that series. And then now just thinking about this one. And certainly, like to your, I get your point that when a young player is playing well and producing, it's much easier for a coach to just keep giving them more rope and just like sending them back out there with you need a more featured role. And so that applies to this next point as well. But just comparing like what you're seeing in this series where Pete DeBoer is leaning on him and Logan Stankoven in this spot where, and I think it's influenced partly by Joe Pavelski's struggles at this point of his career, particularly as we've spoken about in this specific matchup where Vegas is so good and adept at neutralizing his biggest strengths as a player offensively. But he's using them and sprinkling in both Johnston and Stankoven to like manufacture additional looks for Robertson and Hintz as well along the way, right? Like we've seen Johnston in full games with those two guys, but we've also seen him like creating for Robertson as well with Stankoven, where he throws them out for a couple shifts here or there, and then all of a sudden creates some easier looks for them. And he's almost using them, regardless of what their regular role is, as kind of like quick bursts of energy or catalysts to help get other offensive players going. And I find that a really fun development, right? And that's what a coach should be doing.
Well, it happened on the Duchesne goal too. I mean, we've seen it. It hasn't happened as much on 5-on-5, but they've gone to pairing Johnston with Duchesne more, and kind of that net front slash bumper role. And I think Johnson's good in the bumper wherever he is, but Duchesne's been struggling to get pucks in the net and everything. I thought Duchesne was better in game four than he'd been all series and then scored in game five. And on the power play perspective, so it's something that Johnson's not only getting used in that role at 5-on-5, there's also elements of let's go out of our way to help him get other guys going. And it's kind of that natural thing, right? Where it's not supposed to be, supposed to is the wrong word here, but like the hockey cliche is like, oh, you put a guy with like the veteran to get him going. And really this is Dallas is using effectively their youngest player. I'd have to compare his and Stankoven's age to make sure I have it exactly right. But like they're effectively using a 20-year-old to make sure this quote unquote veteran team gets moving. Like that's a huge testament to what he's doing. And it's a credit to Pete DeBoer too, because for as much as sometimes people will be like, oh, they never trust young players, they never trust young players, they let a teenage Wyatt Johnston play 82 games last year. They let Thomas Harley step in and completely shelve older quote unquote veteran players last year. So as much as Pete DeBoer sometimes gets a rap from Stars fans of, oh, he doesn't trust young guys, it's not actually the truth. He trusts young guys, but
Well, and Sean, I mean, he trusts Nils Lundqvist enough to sit on the bench for 57 minutes at a time. Sorry, I had to throw that out there. No, I had to.
I one of the great things, I was reading my pal Robert Tiffin's post game piece after that game, and he said he hoped that in the second half of game five that Lundqvist and Dorofeev like got out a game of Battleship or something like that, so they could play Battleship across the benches, so they at least could find something to be competitive at.
We need a story on what's Lundqvist's like regimen during these games. Like, is he like taking walks in the tunnel? Is he going out for a spin during TV timeouts? Because I imagine sitting for that long is going to lead to like not only just being sore, but potentially even cramping up.
Like it's he is the and I've written this and I've said this, and I know no team would ever do it, but if you're Dallas and right now you're at a spot where you might have forwards coming back, wouldn't is this the this is the one time where a coach should be crazy enough to go 13-5, because Joe Pavelski's struggling to get it going. You got some health stuff. Like, you wouldn't have preferred maybe 4 or 5 minutes of Maverick Bork occasionally jumping into the lineup as a forward instead of basically playing five defensemen with those Lundqvist playing 2 minutes.
Well, I think certainly if Faxa and Marchman were healthy, I think that would actually be a realistic consideration, right?
I think so.
Because the past three games, I mean, I jotted it down. I'm looking for it right now. Yeah, 257, 109, 221. And I was morbidly curious to see in that game three that went to overtime, if it had become like a crazy four overtime game, at what point
Well,
Pete DeBoer would have been like, I got to send him out there. Because obviously it would have been unfair to Lundqvist after sitting for that long to just get thrown into the fire, but also like at some point he would have had to, just because he cannot possibly use Chris Tanev and Ryan Suter and guys like that much.
Well, it's he. I kind of joke at the spot where it's like, I think Nils Lundqvist should have picked a higher number. Because he has yet, like, I think Pete looks at the number on his back and says, that's how many shifts you're getting. And so I like Nils needs to change his number to like 74 or something like that so he could get more shifts.
Yeah, just offer a bunch of money for Matt Duchesne's 95. See if he can work his way up there. Yeah. No, I mean, he's certainly not infallible, but I think in the aggregate, still has done a good job in that sense in trusting these guys and putting in a position to succeed. And so I think it's a massive net positive, especially when you compare it to the way other coaches tend to operate this time of year. But yeah, that dynamic of sort of coaches and young players and who they trust is so interesting. And like a favorite of mine, Tommy Novak. I know he's not young in terms of age, because I think he's 27 years old at this point, but young in terms of NHL experience. He's played fewer NHL games than Wyatt Johnston has, because it took him so long to get to this point. You're watching in this series, and it's like the Preds have 7 5-on-5 goals in 5 games against the Canucks, and it's been an absolute slog generating any sort of offense. And he just clearly does not, Andrew Brunette does not trust him in the defensive zone, to the point where I think he has zero defensive zone starts so far in the series, and he's playing less than any other Predators forward, which was not the case. Like at the end of the season when they were winning, he was essentially getting second line minutes on this team. And now, because of the situation, you're seeing guys like Michael McCarron just playing significantly more than him in these matchup assignments. And I think there's an irony to it because the Predators are need to attack off the rush, for example, right? And I think Tommy Novak is one of their better players at helping transition the puck from the defensive zone into the neutral zone and then into the offensive zone to accomplish that. Yet he's not really getting the opportunity to do so because he just never trusted to actually play in the defensive zone. So in a way, it's like a catch 22. It's like, all right, this the one thing this guy does isn't even being allowed to really materialize because of the lack of trust, right? And I think that's where fans get frustrated with coaches when it's like, ah, if we're gonna lose, let's at least do so in a way where like it encourages hope for the future beyond losing with all of our oldest players being responsible. So yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if there's a right answer, but it's always fun to see this time of year kind of how certain coaches deal with it.
Well, you can't be a it's kind of the classic thing in life sometimes of like, how do you, it's like, oh, I want someone more experienced. Well, how does someone gain more experience? They play more games. Like, I mean, Wyatt Johnson's a perfect example. Wyatt Johnson is an experienced, quote unquote, NHL player. He's 20 years old. And you know what? The Stars have created an experienced NHL player at 20 because they let him play all 82 games in back-to-back years. They have let him play big minutes. You can become an experienced player at 20. It's not tied to age. And that's another Wyatt Johnson lasting legacy here, I think.
Anything else on that series that's kind of caught your eye or you think is relevant to note? They're playing the game six on Friday night,
They're
so
playing the game six tonight, so it's kind of could be there. And I know you went deep on it the other day with David and everything like that. So maybe to me, the one thing that's been the other thing that's just been, I wonder on this whole Lundqvist thing, it's the perspective of, how long can you get away with this in the long run if Yanni Hakanpaa, like, because allegedly the whole thing coming into the playoffs was like, oh, once Hakanpaa's healthy, he'll come in. Hakanpaa's not even close. He's not skating with the team. Like, how long can you do this? That's the other thing that's just the fascinating part to me, where Vegas is gonna take a chunk out of you, right? And you're doing it with effectively playing five defensemen the entire time. What's going to happen once you start hitting games 12, 13, 14 of the playoffs if you advance, and you've still been doing this against Colorado because that's who they play in the next round if they get by Vegas? That to me is just a fascinating thing to watch with this Dallas team, because at some point Pete DeBoer is either going to have to trust Nils Lundqvist, or they're going to have to trust an AHL type player until Yanni Hakanpaa comes back.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, especially if you're getting into games 12 and potentially 13 of the postseason, that means you're deep in an Avalanche series. And we know with the pace they play at and the physical demands of that, that's like as challenging as this Golden Knights series is for a defenseman for a variety of reasons. I think that one is almost like tenfold in so many other ways. So, yeah, that'll be certainly taxing and demanding on those guys. Do you have any notes on? As I think we've covered enough of those series, just like general NHL news, something that's sort of gotten a lot of attention this week has been this whole Rod Brind'Amour thing with his extension and contract status with the Hurricanes, which I guess if there's a time to do it during the postseason, it's while you're waiting to start your next round, because you just finished off round one and you're waiting for round two to commence. But certainly interesting timing, and it seems like it was like this 24-hour news cycle, and there was that classic negotiating and like using the media to sort of get a little bit of leverage. And it seems like it has been sorted. But do you have any kind of notes on that and just kind of the general practice, I guess, of the insider's role in facilitating a lot of this stuff?
I mean, it's I have
As
one coach who
per my last tweet.
I have sweet. I have one a I have there's a couple coaches, it's funny, who I have spoken to before who have left the impression before to me, where it's like, oh, hey, keep my name in mind on things. And there's guys too, there are coaches who definitely are playing the game, and they ask for favors without asking for them. And the whole interesting thing about the Brind'Amour thing to me has been, somehow in an industry that has never been more volatile, right? Like, we've had like 25 coaching changes like in the last 2 years. Like, the fact Bruce Cassidy is the most tenured coach in the Pacific Division is downright laughable. And it's this position, this coaching position, is so much more volatile and everything like that. And we have one guy who is in kind of that group of probably like there's probably about four or five coaches in our minds where like, oh, that guy will actually get to leave on his quote unquote own terms, right? And now he's getting kind of roped into it, and it's kind of this interesting question of it tests the morals of how the Hurricanes want to run things. And there's been two things that have happened this week with how the Hurricanes want to run things. The Hurricanes, it's fitting, honestly. One of the reasons the Hurricanes and the Chicago Wolves split was because Tom Dundon, the owner of the Hurricanes, is effectively wanted more control of AHL operations. But also, all of these things also come down to money. Everything comes down to money. We've heard the stories in Carolina how Tom Dundon is willing to spend the cap on his players, but other things, you're going to try to find the best possible financial deal for yourself to do it. Tom Dundon is the person who has told me point blank that if he could, he would make the Hurricanes jersey look like a NASCAR jersey so he could sell 16 ads all over the place. They won't let him. And so this is testing kind of the morals of one of the reasons hockey operations has worked so well in Carolina is because Rod Brendamore has been willing to work there for less than market value. This is a team where the team president for business and the GM are the same person. No other NHL team has those people as the same job. Those are two very different jobs. And Don Waddell, for whatever he's getting paid, is not getting paid enough to do both of those jobs, but he's willing to do it. Dundon has basically been kind of running on this system where he gets the people who are willing to do this or willing to stay in a place they like and do it for a little bit less to take the hometown discount. Rod Brendamore is starting to realize that, you know what? There's probably 20 teams in the NHL that would probably fire my coach right now to bring Rod in. And I think he's starting to realize that. And now he's going to push back against the, and that's kind of, it's kind of this clashing of what are the defining morals of how Dundon is running his team. And he has to break one of them because he's got two of them. One is Rod Brendamore makes everything go. Two is we don't spend a lot of money. He has to break one of them right now. And it's going to be the one where he doesn't want to spend a lot of money because he's going to keep Rod Brendamore.
Well, also another one of them from just general business practice, and I think it's done them well. It's caused some issues along the way, but it's also done them well in terms of like maintaining flexibility and being always available to add players and make whatever deal they want to, and always being involved in a lot of these, like, all right, someone's available, the Hurricanes are interested, even if they don't always accomplish a deal, is internally setting a value on what everyone is worth. And if it exceeds it, it's like, all right, well, this isn't for us. And the issue with that in this case is that Rod Brindamore's value is whatever another team is willing to pay him.
Correct.
Right? It's not necessarily what you set it at. And so in that sense, if there's a team, cough, cough, Seattle, that has an opening and a connection, and they're like, hey, we're going to go crazy on this, all of a sudden that forces kind of pushes you in an interesting into a corner where you're like, all right, do I match that and go out of my comfort zone in that sense? Or do I, like, what do I do with it? Right. And so I think that's what we kind of saw, but I'd be shocked if he went anywhere just because it'd be an absolute great
I
move
think the
considering how successful they've been and what he means to that organization, even beyond just this coaching tenure.
I do think they'll get it done. I'm not pretending to be a quote unquote insider or anything, but I do think they'll get it done just from the space. But I think it's one of those that required this public. It kind of required it required it required Rod's agent to send a call or a text to someone to say, "Hey, they pulled the off. We they this isn't going as smooth as it should be right now," and that gets people asking questions. So.
Yeah, I'm gonna need you to post a tweet about this.
Yep.
Anyways, all right, Sean, this is a blast. Everyone, go follow your work. We're gonna have you on again soon. I wanted to, on the theme of coaching, I wanted to talk about all the Pittsburgh stuff and Mike Sullivan, but you know what? I don't think that's necessarily imminent, and those could be famous last words because something could happen in the meantime. They did just fire Todd Reirden, but I think next time I have you on, I want to get more into that because I think this conversation of coaching and the way they're treated as assets for an organization is a very fascinating one, but we'll have more time to dive into that. Keep up the great work, man. Enjoy this weekend of games, and we'll have you on again soon. Thank you to everyone for listening. Next time you hear from us, we'll be doing our round two preview, I think. So time really is flying by when you're having fun. This is a blast. Thank you for listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.